Supplements. Perpetual Peace. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Supplements. Perpetual Peace by Immanuel Kant. First Supplement. Of the Guarantee of Perpetual Peace. The guarantee of perpetual peace is furnished by no less a power than the great artist Nature herself. Natura daedala rerum. The mechanical course of nature visibly exhibits a design to bring forth concord out of the discord of men, even against their will. This power as a cause, working by laws which are unknown to us, is commonly called fate. But in view of the design manifested in the course of the world, it is to be regarded as the deep wisdom of a higher cause, directed towards the realization of the final purpose of the human race, and predetermining the course of the world by relation to it, and as such we call it providence. This power we do not indeed perceive externally in the artistic formations of nature, nor can we even infer from them to it. But as in all referring of the form of things to final causes generally, we not only can, but must conjoin this thought with them in order to make their possibility conceivable after the analogy of the operations of human art. The relation and accord of these things to the moral purpose which reason immediately prescribes to us can only be represented by an idea which theoretically, indeed, transcends our experience, but which is practically determinable and is well founded in reality. Such, for example, is the idea of a perpetual peace being a duty when the mechanism of nature is regarded as conducing to its realization. The employment of the term nature rather than providence for the designation of this power is more proper and more modest in view of the limits of human reason, when we are dealing with it merely from the theoretical and not from the religious point of view. For human reason, when dealing with the relation of effects to their causes, must keep within the limits of possible experience, and to speak of providence as knowable by us in this relation would be putting on Icarian wings with a presumptuous rashness, in order to approach the mystery of his unfathomable purposes. Before determining this guarantee more exactly, it will be necessary to look first at that state of things arranged by nature for those who live and act upon the stage of her great theater, which ultimately gives the guarantee of peace. Thereafter, we shall consider the manner in which this guarantee is furnished. The provisory arrangements of nature, in this relation, consist mainly in these three things. First, she has provided so that men shall be able to live in all parts of the earth. Second, she has scattered them everywhere by means of war, so that they might populate even the most inhospitable regions. And third, by this same means, she has compelled them to enter into relations more or less rightful with one another. The facts that come here into view are truly wonderful. Thus, in the cold, icy wastes around the Arctic Ocean, there grows the moss, which the reindeer scrapes forth from beneath the snow in order that it may itself become food, or that it may be yoked to the sledge of the Ostiak or the Samoyan. And in like manner, the wildernesses of sand, barren though they be, do yet contain the camel, which appears to have been created for travelling through them, in order that they might not be left unutilized. Still more distinctly does design appear when we come to know how, along with the fur-clad animals on the shores of the Arctic Ocean, there are seals, walruses, and whales, that furnish food by their flesh, and warmth and light by their fat to the inhabitants around. But most of all does the provident care of nature excite our admiration by the driftwood which it brings to the treeless shores, even when it is not well known whence it comes. And yet, without this material, the dwellers in the region could neither construct their canoes, nor their arms, nor huts for their abode. And this, too, under such conditions as compel them to carry on war against the wild beasts, so that they have to live at peace with each other. Moreover, it is remarkable that it was probably nothing but war that drove men into different regions, and the first instrument of war which man appropriated to himself from among all the animals was the horse, which he had learned to tame and to domesticate in the early period of the populating of the earth. For the elephant belongs to the later period of the luxury which arose with established states. In like manner, the art of cultivating certain grasses called cereals, which are now no longer recognizable by us in their original condition, as well as the multiplication and improvement of species of fruits by transplanting and grafting them, could only arise under the conditions of regulated states, when property in the soil had been rendered secure. These arts could only arise after men, who had been previously existing in lawless freedom, had advanced from the mode of life of the hunter, the fisher, and the shepherd, to that of the cultivator of the land. Then, in connection with the life of the agriculturalist, salt and iron were discovered, which were perhaps the first articles that were sought far and near, and which entered into the commercial intercourse of different peoples. Thereby they would be first brought into a peaceful relation to one another, and thus the most distant of them would come to mutual understanding, sociability, and pacific intercourse. Now, as nature has provided so that men could thus be able to live everywhere on the earth, she has likewise, at the same time, despotically willed that they shall live everywhere upon it, although against their own inclination, and even without any idea of duty being connected with this determination through a moral law. On the contrary, she has chosen war as the means of attaining to this end. In point of fact, we see certain peoples whose unity of descent is made known by the unity of their language, far divided from each other. Thus, the Samoyeds on the Arctic Ocean are of the same race as other tribes speaking a similar language 1,000 miles away from them in the Altaian Mountains. Another race of Mongolian origin, equipped with horses and of a warlike character, having pressed in between them, and having thus driven the former apart from the latter into the most inhospitable regions, whither their own inclination would certainly never have carried them. In like manner, the Finns in the northernmost tract of Europe, where they are called Lapps, have been separated by as great a distance from the Hungarians, who are affiliated to them in language, by the intrusion of Gothic and Sarmatian races. Nor can anything else but war well account for the presence in the far north of America of the Eskimo, a race entirely distinct from all the other American tribes, and perhaps descended from early European adventurers. And the same may be said of the Pechere, who have been driven into Tierra del Fuego in the far south of America. Nature has thus used war as the means of getting the earth everywhere populated. War, however, requires no special motive for its explanation. It appears to be ingrafted on human nature, and is even regarded as noble in itself, man being stimulated to it by the love of glory without regard to selfish interests. Thus, martial courage, not only among the American savages, but even among Europeans in the age of chivalry, was considered to be of great value in itself, not merely in time of war, as was right enough, but just because it was war, and thus war was often entered upon merely to show off this quality. An inherent dignity was thus attached to war itself, so that even philosophers have glorified it as giving a certain nobleness to humanity, unmindful of the Greek saying that war is bad in that it makes more bad people than it takes away. So much, then, in reference to what nature does in carrying out her own design in regard to the human race as a class of her creatures. The question then arises as to what is the essential meaning and aim of this design of a perpetual peace. It may be put thus: what does nature do in this respect with reference to the end which man's own reason presents to him as a duty, and, consequently, what does she do for the furtherance of his moral purpose in life? And further, how does she guarantee that what man ought to do according to the laws of his freedom, and yet does not do, shall be done by him without prejudice to his freedom, even by a certain constraint of nature? And how does she secure this in all the three relationships of public right, as political right, international right, and cosmopolitan right? When I say of nature that she wills a certain thing to be done, I do not mean that she imposes upon us a duty to do it, for only the practical reason, as essentially free from constraint, can do this. But I mean that she does it herself, whether we be willing or not. Fata volentum ducunt, nolentum trahunt. First, even if a people were not compelled by internal discord to submit to the coercion of public laws, war, as an external influence, would affect this. For, according to the arrangement of nature already indicated, every people finds another pressing upon it in its neighborhood, and it must form itself internally into a state in order to be equipped as a power so as to defend itself. Now, the republican constitution is the only one which perfectly corresponds to the rights of man, but it is at the same time the most difficult to found, and still more so to maintain. So much is this the case, that many have asserted that the realization of a true republic would be like a state formed by angels, because men, with their selfish inclinations, are incapable of carrying out a constitution of so sublime a form. In these circumstances, then, nature comes to the aid of the rational and universal will of man, which, however honored in itself, is impotent in practice, and it does this just by means of these selfish inclinations. Thus it comes that the chief interest turns only upon a good organization of the state, which is certainly within the power of man, whereby the powers of the human will shall be so directed in relation to each other that the one will check the destructive effects of the other, or nullify them, and hence the result will be, as regards reason, the same as if these forces did not exist when their evil effects are thus neutralized. And man, although not possessed of real moral goodness, yet becomes constrained to be a good citizen. The problem of the institution of a state, however hard it may appear, would not be insoluble even for a race of devils, assuming only that they have intelligence, and it may be put as follows: a multitude of rational beings, all requiring laws in common for their own preservation, and yet of such a nature that each of them is inclined secretly to accept himself from their sway, have to be put under order, and a constitution has to be established among them so that although they may be antagonistic to one another in their private sentiments, they have yet to be so organized that, in their public relations, their conduct will have the same result as if they had no such bad sentiments. Such a problem must be capable of solution, for it does not turn directly upon the moral improvement of men, but only upon the mechanism of nature. And the problem is to know how men can use the conditions of nature in order so to regulate the antagonism of the hostile sentiments at work among the people, that the individuals composing it shall have to compel each other to submit to common compulsory laws, and that there shall be thus brought about a state of peace in which the laws have full power. This process may be seen going on in the actual existing, although still very imperfectly organized, states. For, in their external relations to one another, they already approach what the idea of right prescribes, although the essential principle of morality is certainly not the cause of it. And indeed, a good political constitution is not so much to be expected from that principle, but rather conversely the good moral culture of a people from such a constitution. Hence, the mechanism of nature, as it works through selfish inclinations which are externally and naturally antagonistic in their operation to each other, may be used by reason as a means of making way for the realization of her own end by the application of a rule of right, and thereby of furthering and securing peace, both internal and external, so far as it may lie within the power of the state to do so. It may then be said that nature irresistibly wills that right shall at last obtain the supremacy. What men may here neglect to do will at length be done of itself, although through much inconvenience. And as Butterweck says, bend but the reed too strong, it breaks. Who wills too much, but nothing makes. Second, the idea of international right presupposes the separation of several neighboring states that are independent of each other, and such a condition of things is of itself already one of war, unless, by their federated union, they can prevent the outbreak of hostilities. Such a condition of things is, however, better, according to the idea of reason, than the fusion of all the states into a universal monarchy by one power that has overgrown the rest and subjected them to its sway. This is so because the laws lose always something of their definiteness as the range of government becomes enlarged, and soulless despotism, when it has choked the seeds of good, at length lapses into anarchy. Nevertheless, there is a desire on the part of every state, or of its sovereign, to attain to a lasting condition of peace by subjecting the whole world, were it possible, to its sway. But nature wills it otherwise. She employs two means to prevent the peoples from intermingling and to keep them apart. These are the differences of their languages and of their religions, which bring with them a certain tendency to mutual hatred, and furnish pretexts to war. However, as civilization increases, there is a gradual approach of men to greater unanimity in principles, and to a mutual understanding of the conditions of peace, even in view of these differences. This pacific spirit, unlike that despotism which revels upon the grave of liberty, is developed and secured not by the weakening of all the separate powers of the states, but by an equilibrium which is brought forth and guaranteed through their rivalry with each other. Third, nature wisely separates the nations which the will of each state, even according to the principles of international right, would fain combine into one by fraud or force. But, on the other hand, she again unites the nations whom the idea of a universal cosmopolitan right would not have secured from violence and war by regard to the mutual interests. This is effected by the commercial spirit, which cannot exist along with war, and which sooner or later controls every people. Among all the means of power subordinate to the regulation of the state, the power of money is the most reliable, and thus the states find themselves driven to further the noble interest of peace, although not directly from motives of morality. Hence, wherever war threatens to break out in the world, the states have an interest to avert it by mediations, just as if they stood in a constant league with each other for this purpose. Thus, great combinations with a view to war can but very rarely occur from the very nature of things, and still more rarely can they succeed. In this way, nature guarantees the conditions of perpetual peace by the mechanism involved in our human inclinations themselves. And although this is not realized with a guarantee that is sufficient to enable us to prophesy the future theoretically, yet the security involved is sufficient for all practical relations. And thus it becomes a duty to labor for the realization of this purpose as not at all chimerical in itself. Second Supplement, Secret Article Relating to Perpetual Peace. A secret article in transactions relating to public right, when viewed objectively, or as to its matter, is a contradiction. Viewed subjectively, however, and considered in reference to the quality of the person who dictates it, it is possible that there may be a secret contained in it, which it may not be compatible with his dignity to have publicly announced as originating with him. The only article of this kind is contained in the following proposition. The maxims of the philosophers regarding the conditions of the possibility of a public peace shall be taken into consideration by the states that are armed for war. It appears, however, to detract from the dignity of the legislative authority of a state, to which we must naturally attribute the highest wisdom, to have to seek for instruction regarding the principles of their practical relations to other states from subjects, even though they be philosophers. Hence, the state will rather encourage them silently, making a secret of the matter, than deal with them directly. This amounts to saying that it will allow them to speak forth freely and publicly their universal maxims regarding the carrying on of war and the establishment of peace, for this they will do of themselves if they are not prohibited from doing it. Nor is there any particular agreement of the states with one another required in this connection in order to their harmonizing on this point, for it lies already in the obligations imposed by the common human reason as a moral lawgiver. It is not, however, meant that the state must give a preference to the principles of the philosopher over the dictates of the jurist, who is a representative of the political authority. It is only meant that the philosopher ought to be heard. The jurist, who has taken for his symbol the scales of right and the sword of justice, commonly uses the latter not merely to keep away all foreign influences from the former, but, should the one scale not sink, to throw his sword into it, and then ve victus, the jurist, who is not at the same time a moral philosopher, is under the greatest temptation to do this, because the function of his office is only to apply existing laws, and not to inquire whether they may be in need of improvement. And further, he reckons this really lower order of his faculty as belonging by its functions to a higher rank, because it is accompanied with power, as holds also of the other two faculties of medicine and divinity. Philosophy thus stands on a very humble stage below these allied authorities. Hence it is said of philosophy that she is the handmaid of theology, and the same has been said of her relation to medicine and law. But it is not easy to see, as has been remarked, whether she bears the torch before these gracious ladies, or carries their train. That kings will philosophize, or philosophers become kings, is not to be expected, nor indeed is it to be desired, because the possession of power inevitably corrupts the free judgment of reason. But kings, or king-like nations, who govern themselves according to laws of equality, should not allow the philosophers as a class to disappear or to be silenced. Rather should they be allowed to speak forth their maxims publicly. Nay, this is even indispensable to both for the mutual enlightenment of their functions. Nor should this process of communicating enlightenment be jealously regarded as a kind of propagandism, because as a class, the philosophers are by their nature incapable of combining into political clubs and factions. End Supplements, Perpetual Peace, by Immanuel Kant. This recording is in the public domain.